We are in a study in the Gospel of Luke, as was mentioned. We'll be in this study for quite a while. It's going to take us a little while to get through the Gospel of Luke, but who's in any hurry? It doesn't really matter. And so if you have a Bible with you, or if you want to follow along on your phone or whatever, open up to Luke chapter 6. If just to catch you up to speed, where we are in the Gospel of Luke is where Jesus is at is in his ministry is that he has just picked his 12 apostles. His apostles were going to be special ones of his disciples. The word disciple just means follower or learner or one who's a, you know, I'm a disciple of. We've used that terminology today and other things saying, I follow this school of thought, I follow this person. He picked all the disciples, and he chose 12 to be apostles. That means the ones that are sent with a mission, the ones that are going to carry on the mission for him. And you can see from verse 14 on there, it shares who they are. Right after that, Jesus then goes from this mountainside where he's at, and in the Gospel of Luke, he goes down, and it says he went to a level place. So Luke is making a distinction here from Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, where Matthew says Jesus went up the mountainside to preach. So they call that the Sermon on the Mount. This is actually a picture of that. And they call the other one in Luke, for whatever reason, the Sermon on the Plain, which is a strange thing to say. It even doesn't even say plain. It just says Jesus went down to a level place, which is just the weirdest thing ever. But I think he's trying to distinguish it that these are different, but there's a lot of similarity. This would have been probably one of Jesus' traveling sermons or whatever that he would have given portions of. And so there's a lot of similarities between Luke's account and Matthew's account. Matthew's is 3 chapters long. Luke is only 1, and he doesn't cover nearly the content that he does. In Luke, though, so we see what's happening here is Jesus is now speaking to these newfound apostles. Behind them, it says, are a bunch of disciples from the area. So there's all these people who are already committed to following Jesus. And behind them, you know, think of it like a concentric circle, but I'm sure they were mixed up all together. But behind them were just people from the region who wanted to check out who Jesus was. And it says they wanted to hear him and they wanted to get healed of their diseases. And so they come to Jesus and he does this amazing thing where he's teaching them. Okay, so in this particular time, it starts in verse 20, but I'm going to shift there a little bit. There's this message he's going to give. Starts in verse 20, goes to the end of the chapter, which we're going to finish today, verse 49. It's called the sermon. We're calling it the greatest sermon ever preached. Again, talking about Jesus, not about what's happening at this moment. Okay, so just to make clear, and then the people are already leaving. What's going on here? No, this is not the greatest sermon ever preached. It's not even the greatest sermon you're going to hear today. Or whatever, but this is you're thinking he did this in 4 parts, and it's pretty average the other 3, and this one's even more average if that's possible. So no, we're talking about Jesus, and he's the one who's teaching this. We've been taking it in 4 chunks. Just to remind you to kind of catch you up to speed, what's Jesus been doing in this Sermon on the Plain? It's I know this is an understatement, but it's genius what he does. And quite honestly, I've never really unpacked it the way I just started reading and doing more study. For me, the Gospel of Luke is a relatively new territory for me, but this is really interesting what he's doing here. But you have to really think, because Jesus is a master teacher, and he says things that are completely, it sounds like, you can't mean what you just said. And he's really trying to communicate some things. And he's using language that is you know, reversed. So we start here, and the first part, the verses 20 to 26 of this message, he twists things upside down, okay? So this is the blessed are the poor, right? Looks at his disciples, verse 20, blessed are you who are poor. And then he says, but woe to you who are rich, okay? And so in one sense that we kind of get that, in our sense that doesn't really make whole. No one says, oh, I'm blessed, I lost my job. Or they're going to repossess my car. Or they're going to take away my house. I mean, you just don't do that. You're blessed, right? No, you're not. That's not. Jesus is getting after something here. And without going through that, if you're interested in more, you could listen to that particular message. It wasn't the greatest message ever preached, but it was a few weeks ago. And what we've said is, what's going on here? What's he trying to say? He's saying what we kind of packed is like, okay, listen, all you people here, similar to what's happening in this room, right? You got people who are really committed. You got people who are committed. And other people are like, yeah, just checking this thing out, right? That's every time you get a Sunday morning. That's exactly what's going on. Sometimes that's even true in our own lives, right? And so you got this whole thing. And Jesus is saying, you want to be my disciples? Here's what it's going to mean. That's what it's going to mean to be my disciple. In order to be a follower of me, you got to understand something. You can't put anything above me. Even good stuff. Okay? So none of the stuff he's going to say is bad. There's nothing wrong with wealth. Right? Except that it's probably the easiest thing to slip into the God category. That's why Jesus, Paul, Peter, Mary, that's an old joke. Anyway, and those over 50 just got it. Peter, Paul, and Mary. Anyway, everybody talks about money because it's very easy, because it slips into that place in our life, as Augustine said, where all of us have a God-shaped vacuum that's only to be meant to be filled by God. And the reality is we try to jam all the things in there, and then the easiest one is money. So what does money do? Well, obviously it gives you wealth. Wealth is just a number. At this very moment in this room, y'all have different numbers. It makes no difference at this moment in this room, right? No difference. But it kind of does. It's something about how you feel, right? So what does wealth actually do then? Well, it gives a sense of power, because I now can make decisions. It gives me an independence. I don't need others. It gives me a sense of control. All of that can be not bad. But Jesus is saying, when that comes to a place where that becomes your God, the thing that fills you, now that replaces me. So guess what? If you have me as your God, in spite of all that, even if you don't have this, you are blessed. He then goes on to talk about hunger. Blessed are you when hungry. No one says that, right? But he's getting at that saying, physical comfort. Even if you have me, and even if you're missing physical comfort, you're still blessed. What about those who weep now? Those who allow life to just knock them on their can. Those who suffer by the pains of life, their own, their others. Well, Jesus says, if you have me and you take me first and you don't try to put that you will line up your circumstances so that they're always, you know, I'm going to do as good as my circumstances are. How are you doing? I'm doing good. I have good circumstances. How are you doing? I'm terrible. I'm rotten. My whole life is upside down because somebody broke the window of my car, right? It's like, well, it's a car window, you know? But it's just, Jesus says, no. And then lastly, he talks about when you're excluded, which we're not made for that. We're made for community, right? God looks at Adam and says, not good the man is alone. Make someone for him. So it creates human community. So it's not good. But here he says, if you have me, then even that thing you were designed for, and it's true, you are designed for all these things, I think. But he says even that, and so you can lay down even reputation. I can even lay down reputation. I can even lay down the fact that I'm excluded. Now, none of those things are what we'd say, man, what's on your prayer list? I hope I'm poor. Man, I want to be hungry, which actually, it's right around noon right now, so there, I did it twice. Told you what time it is. Probably like a little bit of that, but nothing what Jesus is talking about here, okay? Probably never experienced that. Most people, if not everyone in this room. Mourning, and I really, you know, I'm really praying, Pastor, people would exclude me, insult me, and reject me. Well, have a terrible day then, right? Get out of here, right? That's the first part. That's how Jesus opens his sermon. Jesus is, we would say that's a crazy way to recruit people to be your follower. You know, first session, completely upside down. So how does he do second session? The second little mini thing. He says, you know what you need to do? You need to love your enemies. Oh, that's easy. And if you were here that week, you remember me saying, I had the hardest time even figuring this out. Because by definition, love is not necessarily a feeling, but love means that I move towards something, that I'm setting my heart towards going after something, wanting something best, and moving towards it so that I enjoy the process, right? That's what I'm going through. Enemy, hate, is the opposite. I am repulsed by something. They're polar opposites. And here Jesus says, love your enemies. It's like, what the world? Doesn't even make any sense. Until you read to the end of the passage, right? If you, this starts in, I can't remember where this passage starts, but he talks about this and then he restates it here. Love your enemies, do good to them, lend to them without expecting anything back. Then your reward will be great and you will be children of the Most High. You're going to be like your Heavenly Father. How's that? Because he is kind to who? The ungrateful and the wicked. And it hit me that, oh my gosh, that's what's happening at this very moment. God, the second person of the Trinity, has come to the world, the one that has been in rebellion against him, either in small or big ways, but we're all wanting to go our own way. He's coming. He's standing right there, Jesus Christ, second person of the Trinity, and at that moment, he's loving his enemies. Who are they? They're you and me. We're the wicked and the ungrateful. Wow. So how do I do that then? Well, the only way we can do that, remember we talked about this, is if that's you and these are the pressures on you, there's just no way. And these are just the pressures from that passage. There's no way I'm going to respond in a good way. But when I start to imprint on what my Heavenly Father has done, I start to get the gospel of God that though I am that guy, Christ moves towards me. Whoa. Therefore, I don't really have anyone on the planet who is my enemy in that sense. It's all level playing field. Now, that doesn't mean I don't have people, I don't like their behavior, there's things about them, that doesn't mean that, but it does mean somehow that I need to respond to them in like kind, in love, because I have been loved. And when I start to do that, I imprint on my Heavenly Father, so when these things start to happen, I am able to react. And last week we talked about this. If that's true, then it affects every single relationship I have. I am not a person who looks down on, to paraphrase this whole thing, I am no longer a person who looks down on anyone on the planet. I just am not that anymore. If that's what the gospel starts to produce in me. And that brings us to today, which is this solid foundation that he's going to talk about. So if you got a Bible with you, open it up again to Luke chapter 6, verses 43 to 49. We're going to finish the chapter. I think where Jesus is going at today, he's going to end this sermon on the plain. He's, you know, we'd broken into four parts. For him, it was just one session there. And he's going to say, you really want to be my follower? This is what it's going to look like. Let's read through the passage, and I'm going to make three stops along the way here. It says, no good tree, this is verse 43, no good tree bears bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. Each tree is recognized by its own fruit. People do not pick figs from thorn bushes or grapes from briars. A good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart, and an evil man brings up evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. For the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? As for everyone who comes to me and hears my words and puts them into practice, I will show you what they are like. They are like a man building a house who dug down deep and laid the foundation on rock. When a flood came, the torrent struck that house but could not shake it because it was well built. But the one who hears my words and does not put them into practice is like a man who built a house on the ground without a foundation. The moment the torrent struck that house, it collapsed and its destruction was complete. Okay, this is it. This is the last part of the Luke's version of the Sermon on the Mount or the Sermon on the Plain, and Jesus is going to use, he's going to use a whole bunch of analogies. So let's get after them. Let's go back up to the top. Like I said, I'm going to make three stops here. He's got three major analogies that he's going to pick up on. First thing, he's going to talk about good trees and bad trees. So let's just take a look at the actual facts or the analogy that he's going after here. No good tree bears bad fruit, or no bad tree bears good fruit, right? And then you're going to recognize each tree by that fruit. People, you don't go to a thorn bush to get a fig, or you don't go to a briar to get a grape. And I do not know agriculture, so I don't even know what a thorn bush or a briar is. I know what a fig is. That's where Fig Newtons come from, right? Yeah. So, and I know what a grape is. But I don't know what a briar is. So I just went and got some pictures here. So, the first thing: good trees, bad trees, right? So on your left there, you've got obviously a living, live tree. It's flourishing, right? And on the right, You have a tree that is not flourishing. I mean, that could be winter, but it looks like not supposed to be. And what I was trying to make a point here is that it's not flourishing, right? Jesus is saying, if you were going to go look for what grows on trees, somebody say money? No, what? Apples. If you're going to go look for an apple, you would probably go to the tree on your left. That would make most sense, right? Jesus is just using a common analogy here, right? Okay, so you're going to go to the tree. It's living and doing well, not the tree on the right. Or then he even wants to get a little more specific, and he says you're going to go to certain places. You're going to recognize a tree by its fruit. So I did happen to pick an apple tree here. You would go to an apple tree to get apples, and you would go to, that's a fig tree, just because Jesus used fig tree, so I figured it was biblical to find a picture of a fig tree. You go to fig tree to find a fig. Now, I know, you're saying, wait a minute, you can graft all these different things. Not Jesus' point. Jesus' point here is, naturally, you go look for apples here, and you go look for figs over there. So now let's get, he's going to tell you what his point is. Because he just used this analogy, but let's see how it's going to go. He's going to say, a good man brings good things out. We'll get to what that phrase means. He's going to explain it in just a minute. Out of the good stored in his heart, and an evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. And then he says, what in the world is he even talking about? And he says, for the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. Now, this is quintessential Jesus, where Jesus will lead you down a pathway of analogy and then bring it a little bit clearer and then boom, say what he means. Okay? So what Jesus is getting at is the last sentence. The mouth speaks what the heart is full of. Or another translation, if you got to love, out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. Okay? That's what he's getting at. And this, as you look at this particular issue, and he says that's coming out of somewhere, it's coming out of either goodness or life or evil or bad. That's what he's saying. Something's going on here, and when it overflows, boom, out it comes. Right? And the Bible contains this, it's really, from cover to cover, it talks about our speech. Proverbs 18:21, I love this one. It says, the tongue has the power of life and death. Or probably a more accurate way to describe this would say, life and death are in the power of the tongue. And those who love it will eat its fruit. Which one are you going to eat, life or death? In other words, your ability to speak into people's lives and say things, it has an amazing amount of power. Incredible. And many of you know that. Many of you grew up in homes where you never heard your folks say, I love you, I'm proud of you. I know for men, that's just a real struggle. I know men who, their old man has been dead for 20 years, they're still trying to get that sucker to say, I'm proud of you, boy. Never did, his old man never said it. It's just something in the power of the tongue that's amazing. It imprints on us. The New Testament oftentimes is quoted in Ephesians 4:29. Paul speaking, and he says, he's speaking to the Ephesians, he says, do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. So what's going on here? What's Jesus talking about this whole thing about good trees, bad trees, and then it's something about your speech. And what he's trying to say, I think, is what R. Kent Hughes says here. Says the inner disposition determines the kind of fruit that comes from one's life. One can attempt an external veneer of goodness, but the truth will become known through one's words and deeds. Significantly, Jesus emphasizes here that the mouth is what provides the primary empirical evidence of the state of one's soul. For out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. So now you should be asking yourself the Ralphie question, right? What if I have a potty mouth and drop the mother of all, right? The great moments in Christmas Story. But, okay, so what I mean by potty mouth here is not what you think I mean. Go back to Ephesians 4:29. Some of you think a potty mouth means they cuss. I'm from the Iron Range, as is my buddy Phil. It's the only language we know up there. We have to, like, listen to you and then, can somebody interpret that? Oh, this is what they meant. Okay, yeah. So, I mean, actually, if you quoted there's verses in the Bible that the English writers don't have the guts to translate the right way. The King James Version. Anybody got a King Jimmy Version? They got the guts to do it a little bit. They get a little bit. Some of the other ones, they sanitize it. So I'm not necessarily talking about, now don't, my pastor just said we can go out cussing all. I didn't say that. Please do not tweet that. But what Ephesians 4:29 actually says, when it says unwholesome, it means unhelpful. It means speech that is not meant to be a blessing. Okay? So there are times where a sharp word, and whatever, can be used, and it's meant to bless you. It's not meant to damage you. Cursing, that phrase means, is you're cursing someone, you're wishing evil on them. That doesn't necessarily, you can curse them without using, a lot of people curse without using, you know, quote unquote, swear words. A lot of people swear when they're certainly not cursing. Okay, so what I'm talking about is a potty mouth. Okay, you just, what comes out is not, yeah, it's what goes in the potty, right? It's not, see, you get fired if you say the right word, but I won't. So anyway, that's, what's that about? Where does that come from? And you know where it comes? It comes in the people you love the most. That makes no sense. Think about that for a minute. I am very nice to my mechanic. I've never said a mean word to my mechanic ever. We've had a few moments where it's like, I think that might be too much or whatever, but if you've been my same mechanic for, geez, how long have we had your 20 years? I don't know. It's great, right? I can't go 20 minutes without saying something to Carol. That's not true. 20 days, for sure. Well, what's that? Why is that? I don't live with Jerry. Jerry is 5 blocks away. I don't have to do anything with him. I live with the woman. We are in the same place. Why do I do that? So yesterday, I had a, we had a big day planned. I had this message to get ready for, and then right after the service, I kind of need to boogie out because I'm one of our church planters. Brian Lair is getting ordained today. He's having a service. He asked me to be the ordination speaker, so I'm running over to McAllister College to, that service starts at 1, so I've got to run over and do that. I had to prep for that too. And so I was kind of stressed out about that. Plus, we had an evening thing that I was not going to miss. We went to see Kim Nelson, one of the people that helped found this church. She joined the Minnesota Roller Girls. So we went to the Roller Girls last night. That's a cultural experience. I'm saying just that's serious. That's a people group unto itself. And so that was just a ball, did that, had this whole thing. And then on the ride home, I'm thinking to myself, it's about 9:30 now, and I get up real early. I get up 4:30 on Sundays. So I'm thinking, I just want to go to bed. I'm going to go to bed. If I can just get to bed, I got to unwind, because otherwise I lay there for 2 or 3 hours and I think. And I just got to unwind. So I come in and I get in the door and I'm thinking, I just want to calm. I just want to put down my whatever I had, phone or whatever, and I just want to leisurely just go up to bed. I just want to go to Happy Land. And Carol says to me, hey, could we take just a couple minutes? Could we take a couple minutes and just pray? In that tone. I'm totally serious. That's what she says. And I turned to her and say, no, we're not going to do that. Why? Because I have to get my sleep so I can talk to people about Jesus. Which is what you want to do right now. Wow. As soon as it came out of my mouth, I'm like, what is going on? And I could see she was asking you like, let's go make a bomb and blow something up. No, not going to do that. Stop asking every day. She said real quick, just close the day in prayer, just together. As soon as I said it, I'm thinking, you spent all day studying this passage. You spent all day thinking about, boy, I have some neat illustrations. I got a great Ralphie photo. This is going to be great, you know? And what just came out of your mouth? What happened there? That's potty mouth. No, I didn't swear. She did. No, I'm just kidding. How do you fix that? Where does good speech come from? Well, that's the point of the parable, or that's the point of what he's trying to say here. He's not actually telling you, fix your speech. If you leave this message thinking, I got to talk better to people, you're not getting the point what Jesus is saying here. He's saying it comes from here. Well, what's going on there? Go back to Ephesians 4:29, which is quoted all the time. I've had people quote me that a lot. You need to fix your language, or you need to do whatever. And it's like, yeah. Go. Let's look at that puppy in context. Paul says this. He says, so I tell you this and insist on it in the Lord. I'm backing up to verse 17. That you must no longer live as the Gentiles do. In other words, he's saying those people outside, that's what, in this context, that's what Gentiles means. The nations, the people who don't know Christ. There's something different about you because you're a follower of Jesus. In the futility of their thinking. And he's going to describe exactly what that looks like. They are darkened in their understanding and separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. Now here it is. Here's the key. Having lost all sensitivity, they have given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity, and they're full of greed. So what happens? I come home. What's on my mind? Me. What I want. I need right now. I gotta get this. What's that? That is indulging in sensuality. It's saying, she doesn't matter. Why would I respond like that? Instead of just saying, oh, you know, I'm really tired. Maybe I'll just, no, it's just this, why? Because I'm right now indulging in my own sensuality, even if it's just tiredness. But tiredness isn't as bad. It's better than this, that, and the other thing. It don't make any blipping difference what it is. I'm indulging in that. Paul says, don't do that. Don't do that. Do this. That, however, is not the way of life you learned when you heard about Christ and were taught in him in accordance with the truth that is in Jesus. You were taught, with regard to your former way of life, to put that off, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, that Christ himself laid down his preference to go to the cross. What? In the garden, before he goes to the cross, he prays, Father, if there's any other way, let's do that. And the unheard answer is there is no other way, because the next thing he says is, not my will, but yours. Christ lays down preference. He comes, he does that for me. He lays it down willingly, completely willingly. Hebrews says, for the joy set before him, he does that. So that's made new in the attitude of my mind. Don't just give in to my whatever I want. Something there. And then to put on the new self. What? How did Jesus do this? What's going on? What would Jesus do? How do I create it to be like God in true righteousness and holiness? In other words, I'm going to pull the gospel message through my life. I'm going to use it this way. Through my gut, through my heart, through my head, and then out my mouth. But if you just tell me, stop talking bad, it ain't going to happen. It ain't going to happen. Then Paul goes into this list of stuff. He says, okay, there now. Those of you who have been lying, speak. You must put off falsehood and speak truthfully. For you're members of one body. In your anger, don't sin. Don't let the sun go down while you're still angry. Do not give the devil a foothold. Anyone who's been stealing must steal no longer, but must work, doing something useful with their own hands, that they may have something to share with those in need. And then lastly, do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths. Put that aside. Be made new. Live new. That's the gospel message pulling through. That it may be helpful for building others up according to needs, that it may benefit those who listen. There's something as a follower of Jesus that changes us on the inside so that the outside looks different, but it has to start from the inside. If you try to just change the outside, you're done. Won't work. And yet there's something about us that says that's who we are, and the evidence of it is this outwardness. Daryl Bach, in his commentary on this passage, says this, Scripture does seem clear that regenerated people do bear some sort of fruit. Total absence of fruit, particularly love, does raise the question about the presence of regeneration of faith. Is that person really a follower of Jesus, right? We are not here confusing salvation by faith with salvation by works. You don't get right with God by right behavior. You get right by God with believing in who Jesus is. We are not saying that works save. Salvation is by faith through grace, but that grace bestows a changed heart that accepts God as Father and responds at least to some degree to his presence. If the seed of new faith is present, it will sprout, though to a varying degrees in different people. Short way of saying it, we're in a Lutheran building, got to quote Luther, we are saved by faith alone, but the faith that saves is never alone. It always accompanies. There's a change here. There's a change here. And you are going to mess up. Well, 8 hours ago, 10 hours ago, there's something that happens. Now, I admit, my first response is, of course, just to apologize and to pray together and to, but man, I drug myself upstairs and I just loathe myself. I hate, Christian, being a follower of Jesus is a very unique experience. In one sense, we're okay completely in Christ. In the other sense, I loathe the sinful nature part. I loathe it. I hate it. Yeah? That's what it is. Second thing, the other two don't take as long, trust me. True belief. True belief. Let's start off here. He's gonna start off with what I would say is one of the most Jesus says the statement and drops the mic statements ever. Seriously. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? That is an amazing passage. Why do you call me Lord? You don't do what I say. Quoted from him last week, R.C.H. Lenski, Lutheran pastor, middle of the 1800s, early 1900s, he says this. He says, mere acknowledgement of calling Jesus Lord is no ticket of admission to heaven. Saying Lord, Lord meets the claim that relation to Jesus, which is expressed in that title. The duplication indicates the urgency made in that claim. Like the word Lord in English, it was often little more than our sir, like a title of respect. But in the present connection, the sense would be lost if less were meant than divine Lord. The point lies in the claim of a connection with Jesus as the divine Lord, Messiah, and Savior, which is spurious, or means false, because those who make it fail to do what he says. Their doing, that is their course of action, fails to call Jesus Lord. So Jesus then uses an analogy. And I'm purposely skipping verse 47. I'll come back to in just a minute. He uses an analogy of what this will look like. The person who does practice and does call him Lord, Lord, but does what he says, he says he's like, and just follow the analogy here, says that person's like a person building a house, and they dig down deep, and they lay the foundation on rock. This church building, we found out when we dug some foundations, is actually down into the limestone of this whole city. So we're not going anywhere. This church is going nowhere until the Metrodome gets bigger and then they take over the whole city. But it's on a rock, right? And he says, when a flood came, the torrent struck that house but could not shake it because it was well built on this rock. Doesn't even say what kind of builder it is, just says he's a good digger. And he got down to that, so this house stood up. So the rock that it's built on, Christ and his word, it's solid. So that's the analogy, right? So then he says, well, how do you get there? So, I mean, analogy has a point, and the point is not find a rock and go, you know, glue yourself to it. And no, the point is there is a rock, and who is that rock? Well, that rock is Christ. That's his point. And he says, here's how you get there. Everyone who comes to me, hears my word, puts them into practice. That's the same, those three words, comes to me, hears my words, and puts them into practice, is this putting yourself on this rock? Okay? Now, let's just think about those three phrases, just real briefly here. First one, comes to me. Even in the business world, the phrase, let's have a come to Jesus meeting, you know, you're coming to Jesus, right? That means we're going to have a very hard conversation. We're going to deal with no more BS here. We're going to talk right to you about something. I think it's pretty accurate. He's saying, you're coming straight to me. You're coming to me. It's important. Come to Jesus. It's personal. Second thing, you hear the words. You hear his words. Now, when he doesn't just mean hear like hear them, he means like they land. Let me give you an example. Tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, I'll be on a Delta flight to Tampa. Before the plane goes off, somebody stands up front and does something with a seatbelt or what are the weirdest thing, and then they flail their arms like this. I don't know if they're drying off their armpits, and then, I don't know, they this thing they put over their face and go like this and put on top this yellow whatever. You know, what is that? Right? Because no one ever listens to it in the history of the world. No one's ever heard that, ever. And this poor people, thousands of times a day, have to say this thing that means absolutely nothing to you until the pilot comes on the intercom and says, "We just lost all electrical power." And you're like, "Oh man, was I supposed to have my tray up or down? Seat back up or back or what? Ah, help," right? Gotta be honest, I'm not sure how much it helps anyway to have your seat back up, but it's just noise. I don't hear that. It's just noise. And Jesus is saying, is this just noise? Is this just noise? Or do you take an urgency to these words? And the last thing he says, you put them into practice. You run them through your head, your heart, and your hands, and you do them. That's what is going on. Then you look at, So I love books that the title is all you need. I'm serious. I love books like that. I am a little bit scattered, if you haven't figured that out by now. If Myers-Briggs, I'm an ENFP, which means that I barely finish sentences. I'm on to something else already. The prayer of an ENFP is, "Oh, Lord, please make me focus to, ooh, look at the money," right? And so that's who we are. So I don't finish a lot of books. That's why I love when the titles are good. Look at the title of this book. Just skip the quote and the picture. Just look at the title. It's by Eugene Peterson. He says, "A long obedience in the same direction, discipleship in an instant society." You can just rip that cover off, throw the book away. That is worth it. I'll read the dumb quote anyway, but this is in the book. It says, "There is a great market for religious experience in our world. There is little enthusiasm for the patient acquisition of virtue, little inclination to sign up for a long apprenticeship in what earlier generations of Christians called holiness." If you go back to those words, not to get all grammar geek here on you for a second, but they're in the perfect tense. We don't really have the perfect tense in English real well. It best comes out as like the present, but it's an ongoing present. In other words, it would be everyone who comes to me and continues repeatedly to come to me. Everyone who hears my word and repeatedly listens and hears my word. Everyone who puts into practice and makes a lifetime of putting those things into practice. What are they like? They are like, as they are going through life and growing and going, they are building this foundation. Okay, what does it look like when that doesn't happen? What does unbelief or false belief look like? And Jesus says, he gives the analogy here, and he says it's like a person built without a foundation. The storm comes, boom, house is gone. There is no foundation to it. Might look the same from the outside, right? But when the storm comes, it just wipes the one out. And look at the only difference. The only difference is, we are assuming, I'm making a grammatical assumption here, and I didn't read any commentators this week that disagreed, that Jesus is inserting but the one who comes to me, like that would be part of it, and hears my words and does not put them into practice is like the man who built the house that didn't have the foundation, right? And remember who he's speaking to. He's speaking to a bunch of people. They've already come to him. They're all standing there. He says, "Listen, some of y'all, you're going to buy this. Some of y'all going to give yourself to it. Some of y'all, boing, just going to bounce off. You know, you have a room this size. This what's going on here?" That's what's going on sometimes in our own experience. So the question then is, If you're a follower of Jesus, how then do we live lives where I'm not calling him Lord, Lord, and not doing what he said? One of my favorite books on this is by a man by the name of Jerry Bridges. If you were here about 4 years ago, in the summer, we did a sermon series based on his book, and the book is called The Pursuit of Holiness. Once again, the thing that impacted me the most was the introduction. Preface, right? You got your foreword, then your preface, that's about as far as I make it. So you put the good stuff right there in the preface. I'm going to read you one page, page 9 of the preface. He says this: a farmer plows his field, sows the seed, and fertilizes and cultivates, all the while knowing that in the final analysis, he is utterly dependent on forces outside of himself. He knows he cannot cause the seed to germinate, nor can he produce the rain or sunshine for growing and harvesting the crop. For a successful harvest, he is dependent on these things from God. Yet the farmer knows that unless he diligently pursues his responsibilities to plow, plant, fertilize, and cultivate, he cannot expect a harvest at the end of the season. In a sense, he is in partnership with God, and he will reap its benefits only when he has fulfilled his own responsibilities. Farming is a joint venture between God and the farmer. The farmer cannot do what God must do, and God will not do what the farmer should do. We can say just as accurately that the pursuit of holiness is a joint venture between God and the Christian. No one can attain any degree of holiness without God working in his life, but just as surely, no one will attain it without effort on his own part. Two primary reasons can be given for this, and I underlined and bold this because this is what hit me upside the head. This is my, I did that, not him. First, we are to simply reluctant to face up to our responsibility. We prefer to leave that to God. Here's the sentence. We pray for victory when we know we should be acting in obedience. Oh, wow. Jerry Bridges is picking up on what the Apostle Paul said. He says, you already got victory in the cross. You got to pray for the strength to obey. How many of us just say, oh, Lord, if you just give me victory in this area, I will obey you? It's like, no, you've been given victory. Now, what's the process to say, I'm going to do it? The second reason is that we do not understand the proper distinction between God's provision and our own responsibility for holiness. I kind of walked you through that with the Ephesians passage, but let me hit you one more time with my favorite passage on this, Philippians chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. Paul is speaking to those people in that church, and he says, therefore, my dear friends, as you have always obeyed, not only in my presence, but now much more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Whoa, that sounds like it's all me, right? Do it. Do it. Do it. Do it. Do it, right? Starsky and Hutch. Anyway, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And then he says, for, that means because, the ground of it, what fuels it is, for it is God who works in you to will, that means your mind, making decisions, and to act in order to fulfill his good purpose. So which is it, God or us? Yes. Yes. The resources are there, but yes, we have to step out. Charles Spurgeon says, faith is the fountain, the foundation, and the foster of obedience. Men obey not God till they believe him. We preach faith in order that men may be brought to obedience. To disbelieve is to disobey. One of the first signs of practical obedience is found in the obedience of the mind, the understanding, and the heart. And this is expressed in believing the teaching of Christ, trusting to his work, and resting in his salvation. You pull the gospel through, but then you do it. Let me close by letting you meet one of my heroes of the faith. This man's name is Richard Wurmbrand. And Richard was born in 1909. He died in 2001. I had a chance to meet him. He was at a conference over at Bethlehem Baptist Church two blocks away in the mid-90s, and I just briefly met him. I didn't even know much about him. In 2000, I had laid up with a major back problem, and people just gave me books that had impacted them to read because I had a lot of time. And Neil Feldhahn gave me this book right here, Tortured for Christ. Richard was he had Jewish descent. He was born, like I said, in 1909. In 1938, through the influence of a carpenter friend, he became a Christian, a follower of Jesus. A few years later, he ended up got ordained as a Lutheran minister. In 1944, so this is right at the end of World War II, Richard starts to have a ministry to the Red Army. And right after the war ends, it's declared that that's not cool. So he goes underground with it, meaning it's going to be private meetings. They're not going to have an open church service like this. It's going to be underground church. It's happening all over the world as well now. In 1948, 4 years later, it's found out he's imprisoned for this, and he is imprisoned for 8.5 years. During that imprisonment, it was interrogating him, trying to convince him, you will not do this in the new Soviet Union anymore. You will not be preaching about Christ. At that time, they didn't have like a state church. I know now in China they do, but at that time, most of the communist nations did not. In 1956, he was released. He was told not to preach ever again. He went immediately back to preaching, and in 1959, he's arrested again, given a 25-year sentence, which would basically be most of his life in prison, and he was going to be, again, these imprisonments were not just mine. I'll let him describe it in just a minute. In 5 years, he was ransomed. He was bought by the Norwegians, and he was able to go to Norway as a political exile. I want to just share with you, because I want to close kind of our whole time in this, because I think his life kind of exhibits this greatest sermon ever preached. What does it mean to give up these things for Christ? What does it mean to love your enemies? What does it mean to not judge other people? And what does it mean to really lay your life and land it on the rock that is Jesus? So let me just give you a few things. First of all, he's going to talk about what time was like in there. He says, the tortures and brutality continued without interruption. When I lost consciousness or became too dazed to give the torturers any further hopes of confession, I'd be returned to my cell. There I would lie, untended and half dead, to regain a little strength so they could work on me again. Many died at this stage, but somehow my strength always managed to return. In the ensuing years, in several different prisons, they broke 4 vertebrae in my back and many other bones. They carved me in a dozen places. They burned and cut 18 holes in my body. When my family and I were ransomed out of Romania and brought to Norway, doctors in Oslo, seeing all this and the scars in my lungs from tuberculosis, declared that my being alive today is a pure miracle. According to their medical books, I should have been dead for years. I know myself that it is a miracle. God is a God of miracles. I believe God performed this wonder so that you could hear my voice crying out on behalf of the underground church in persecuted countries. He allowed one to come out alive and cry aloud the message of your suffering, faithful brethren. Then he'd go on and describe what it was like for them there, as there's many people in this prison, but there were people who were Christians. And he says, it was strictly forbidden to preach to other prisoners. It was understood that whoever was caught doing this received a severe beating. A number of us decided to pay the price for the privilege of preaching. So we accepted the communist terms. It was a deal. We preached, and they beat us. We were happy preaching. They were happy beating us. So everyone was happy. And here's what he says about what he feels about those very people. I've seen Christians in communist prisons with 50 pounds of chains on their feet, tortured with red-hot iron pokers, in whose throats spoonfuls of salt had been forced, being kept afterward without water, starving, whipped, suffering from cold, and praying with fervor for the communists. This is humanly inexplicable. It is the love of Christ which was poured out into our hearts. Now, my intention sharing it with you is not to say that's what's going to happen or whatever. But I think it exemplifies exactly what Jesus is talking about this Sermon on the Mount. Sermon on the Plain, excuse me. That there's just something about being a follower of Jesus. It's not just a worldview. It's something different. It's life-changing. And in extreme circumstances, he will grant to you the power and the ability to be something. It's inexplicable. How can that be? And that's what he exhibits. This man exhibits the Sermon on the Plain. So let me close by asking you a couple questions. Number one, do you call Jesus Lord? And for some of you in the room, that might not be the case, and you might not be there. And today might be the day where you say, today I'm gonna step out and take Jesus Christ as Lord, Savior, today. Others of you, that might be the case. You're saying, yes, the majority of you in the room. Imagine you're here because of that. Then the question is, are we obeying him? Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? And then lastly, in that, how is unbelief in the gospel message and what he's done for you hindering your obedience? Let's pray together.